Okay, this is program number 596, broadcast number 596. It is May the 9th already, and it is 1983. I usually give about a one-minute rundown of what happened this time last year. We were talking this time last year about, the Antarctica war with Great Britain, the importance of Antarctica and Argentina, and that gets back to Alternative 3 that I was talking about earlier on the talk show. The book Antarctica, My Destiny by Captain Finn Rone, R-O-N-N-E, and also the importance of Admiral Byrd and the secrets of Admiral Byrd's expeditions, and Lowell Thomas, who worked for the CIA, and Curtis LeMay, and the team that covered up what Admiral Byrd saw and his 1946 expedition. That would be the one right after the war, if, in fact, the top Nazis were able to escape to Argentina and Antarctica. I also was talking about John Hinckley and the trial that would be coming up, the rich boy covering up his American Gestapo posse comitatus Nazi connections, that he would use his insanity plea, which he did and got off with. Dan White, the San Francisco policeman, used the Twinkie defense for killing the supervisor and the mayor in San Francisco. And now Mr. Miller's, the son of Ronald Reagan's attorney, is using the insanity plea. He's not going to have a trial yet because he raped and murdered his mother because he wets his bed. That was the big problem. So you get Twinkies and you get Jodie Foster and you get bedwetting, and the very rich seem to get out of their problems very nicely. I got a call this morning. There was an obituary in the paper. It was so small I didn't even see it. Chester Davis, you know who he is? Chester Davis, personal attorney to Howard Hughes for the past 16 years, for the last 16 years, of the billionaire's life. He died in upstate New York. He was a native of Rome. I'll do a whole broadcast or a half of a broadcast next week on him. He was part of the Mormon Mafia, working with the Rome Vatican Mafia. He was an Italian mafiosa who came out. He was a chauffeur. He was a gopher for Hollywood, for the starlets, and for Terry Moore, and he ended up making 30, 40, 80 million. I lost track, but I have it at home, off the Hughes organization. He was one of the links of the Mormon Mafia. It was half mafiosa from Italy and half Mormon from Utah, the common denominators being David Kennedy in Utah, an elder of the church who worked with Michael Sindona, God's banker from Rome. He's in jail. They've both been charged with murder and taking money out of various banks in Italy and in the United States. The common denominator of Howard Hughes' captivity was the Mormon Church and the Vatican, and they took him and made an umbrella for the Nazification of the United States and the U-2 flights, and the organized crime syndicate took over the Hughes organization, took his body to Boston. It was never seen again, moved into Vegas, bought up various hotels. Chester Davis is very much part of Americana history, just as Charles Bluedorn was when I did the programs on Gulf and Western. He was on page 19, a 2-inch obituary. He died Thursday, almost unnoticed. So we'll a little more on Chester Davis next week. Also, a top executive choked at the Capitol in D.C., the top executive of Grace Company, from Vice President of W.R. Grace, Senior Vice President Richard L. Bowditch, B-O-W-D-I-T-C-H, choked in Washington. I just got that from a World Watcher in New York City today, and we'll do more on that later. This last week, I talked about the chain of connection to the Bulgarian assassination attempt on the Pope being broken. The London Times says that's falling apart. There is no link. And then the next day on NBC News, Tom Brokaw gave a big smile and said, I'll give you Marvin Kalb. And Marvin Kalb had a program, or what do they do on NBC News, a two-minute little blurb. Marvin Kalb reported tonight that the top officials of the CIA are leaning away from the theory that there was a Bulgarian connection. The CIA never had that theory, and Mr. Casey never went for it at all. He's kept silent through this whole thing. This has been NBC and Marvin Kalb and Michael Ledeen and the propagandist Claire Sterling, that shtick that it was a Bulgarian or a KGB that shot at the Pope. Marvin Kalb was on the air saying CIA Director William Casey is leaning from that theory. CIA Director William Casey has changed his mind and believes there may not be a Bulgarian connection in the papal assassination plot. Finally, they give a shooting attempt the word plot. We'd never get that in the United States. Then Kalb went on, this has been confirmed by a key CIA official. As KCI's source, it represents a victory of sorts for Casey's deputies. They have been very skeptical of this connection. And when this approach came to light, the State Department officials demanded and got an investigation. It was conducted by the CIA, which cleared its agents. Now, that's a funny way to say it. I played the tape back and typed it up. The agent that worked from the CIA with Aja right at the Vatican Square and up through the whole thing was Frank Turpel. And it slipped in, and as I say, I played it back and typed it. The investigation cleared its agents. Did you know the CIA was even considered as part of the plot to shoot the Pope? Well, anyway, the Marvin Kalb was saying that Antonov, Serge Antonov, may be released, that they're planning to release him. And then he backtracked and said that Ronald Reagan has confirmed that he'll go away, he'll go with whatever investigation is going. I doubt if he will, but if it turns out that Aja did, in fact, get his gun from the Galen Nazi operation, which he did, it will get faded away in the news. You remember how the Tylenol story faded away? The Tylenol suspect, he had an operation for throat cancer about a month ago. Mr. Lewis, you haven't heard a word about him. Another story I want to update before most of the program is going to be on the Hitler diaries. W.R. Grace & Company acquires a DeLorean subsidiary. Isn't that great? Grace acquired Composite Technology Corporation, a subsidiary of DeLorean Motor Company. I believed all along that John DeLorean was linked with J. Peter Grace and Opus Dei and the Sovereign Military Order of Malta, and that he had a very high role in espionage, and the cocaine connections were just a minor part of the whole story. So it's interesting that Mr. Grace, with his strong Vatican Nazi links, is now buying one of DeLorean's companies. It was sold to Grace's Emerson and Cummings subsidiary. Now, what they may have bought was the list of people that they did business with. That may be as important as anything else in the whole story, is to combine the names and call it a business. It could be just a front of a sort. It's called Composite Technology Corporation, a plastic subsidiary of DeLorean Motor. Also, I have to just briefly mention, do more later, Patty Hearst kidnapper Bill Harris paroled. 1974, I wrote the SLA is the CIA. It is, it was, and it always will be. Now, Mr. Harris got out of jail and went to the attorney who represented Russell Little when he shot and killed the school superintendent up in Oakland. He went up to that law office. And he's going to be a paralegal or maybe go on to Indiana, where he can work for the Spiro Agnew YAF group that he came from originally as a narc in Indiana. They had nerve to say, Mr. Hanlon, the attorney, said, he's not involved in politics. He doesn't want to be involved in politics. He doesn't want to be a spokesman. A spokesman for what? For putting a student in a closet, for raping her, to have men line up and screw her, you know, in a closet, drug her, and kidnap her to cross state lines to make her sit and watch the television where their six friends are cremated on the dinner hour. And then they go to the Carmichael Bank. Patty has a getaway car. And Mrs. Harris, Emily Harris, they shoot and kill a woman, a mother of four children, up at the Carmichael Bank. What they have in common with the Hearst is that the Hearst family paid off this particular family so that they wouldn't be charged with murder. So they're out easy. What kind of politics? They have the nerve on the news to say he doesn't want to talk at campuses. What? Compare yourself to G. Gordon Liddy even, or Timothy Leary. These cruddy people who were in counterintelligence, narcs, brutally cold people. What are they going to talk about in politics? Now, just this is really mean. I have to put something mean in this evening. I'm usually very nice. I was reading The Last Days of the Late Great State of California by Kurt Gentry. It came out in 1968. And I was looking up the references to Ronald Reagan's early career because he had him down pat and blamed him for half of what was happening in this state. But in the book, he says, when Reagan was running for governor, he went to speak at Coalinga Junior College. That's the place where they had the earthquake that decimated the town. The whole town's down in rubble. Okay. Coalinga Junior College, when Reagan was campaigning, he was questioned about the Far Eastern situation, and Reagan advocated declaring war on North Vietnam. We could pave the whole country and put parking strips on it and still be home for Christmas. Declaring war would have another benefit. It would end the peace marches. It's kind of ironic. I bet all the people at Coalinga voted for Reagan, but maybe the karma came back, and now Coalinga is a parking lot instead of North Vietnam. That's very nasty of me, but I thought it was kind of funny that he chose that place to make his famous speech, considering what happened in Coalinga. It isn't funny at all, but it caught my attention. Okay, a missing ex-General Motorade found slain in New York State Lake, Mr. George M. Perry. I got a letter from a world watcher that sent me this New York Times article, and he said, "May, before I listened to you, this wouldn't have meant much to me. Thanks for your help in understanding the news." It's a story about a man, George Perry, who's worked for General Motors 30 years. That's all during the John DeLorean time. He was found. He was murdered January of 83. His body was found in a park in New York with 322 caliber bullets. Now, it's interesting that some people are getting a little smarter than they used to be. The New York Times says that George M. Perry may have worked for the United States intelligence, and they're looking into details and his record in World War II. Is it possible that journalists are actually going back to the connections of World War II, which is very essential that I keep harping on week after week and trying to illustrate the linear connection of these people working in espionage with top Nazis, with the CIA, the OSS became the CIA, and setting up what became the Odessa, the Nazi network, in hopes to take over the whole world again. Mr. Perry spent most of his time out of the country, 30 years with General Motors. He was in Scotland, European continent, and South America. He was about to move in Brazil. He was on his way to Zurich, Switzerland. He served in Argentina and Bolivia. That's the Claus Barbie country. In 72, he was named managing director of General Motors in Argentina. General Motors and the Ford Motor Company were, and ITT, were the three notorious funders of Adolf Hitler, of double dealing and selling during the war, after the war, espionage covers, and so forth. So this fellow at the time in January, when John DeLorean is arrested, when Roberta Calvi's been hung a few months earlier, when Licio Gelli of the Vatican from Argentina, where this man lived, is in jail as of September. That's right, the same day before Grace Kelly was killed. The network of agents is closing in, and there are seems to be a lot of murders of people that have touched all these bases. So this is an interesting kind of obituary. They found his body just last week, and I'm sure we'll hear more about George Perry, or maybe we won't. But a lot of these interesting characters, I call them the millionaires, are being offered. In fact, I did one or two programs on just the necessity of killing particular millionaires, heads of corporations that have a part in the direct espionage activity of our government. And because certain people have been arrested, like Mr. Michael Sindona in a New York jail, Edwin Wilson is in jail, Licio Gelli is in a Swiss jail, there's a lot of people, if they aren't killed, like Roberta Calvi or the witnesses I mentioned last week, they're sitting in jail, and goodness knows how much is going to come out. And Klaus Barbie's been brought back from Bolivia, a home base of this guy, so his pals, I guess, from Bolivia and Argentina are on the run, and he's found with 322 bullets in the head. Now, I mentioned that each week I'm going to do a section on the John Kennedy assassination. In fact, everything that I do on this program and have done for the past 12 years has to do with the people who killed John Kennedy, but did a lot of other murders too, death squads, but they had a role in the Kennedy murder. And I want to specifically do a lot on John Kennedy every week and tie it together because it's the 20th anniversary of his death. And I will get back to the YAF, the Young Americans for Freedom. I did two broadcasts on that, and I'll do more. But the Hitler diary saga is so important that I'm going to do some other stories with you and get back to that. But I want to share one chapter of a book called Kissinger, The Portrait of a Mind. This is a book by Stephen Graubard, Graubard, published by Norton, W.W. Norton and Company, in 1973. And this is quite a detailed account of the life of Henry Kissinger. I got it from the library, so if any of you can find it at a used bookstore, I'll put you on the look for it. I have to own this one. And it tells about his career and with Mr. Fritz Kramer in the Army and how he goes to Harvard and he's a student. and how he's brought to New York City to be with the Council of Foreign Relations and with Nelson Rockefeller. And it has what he was doing during the Eisenhower years and then what he was doing during the Kennedy-Johnson years. It carries his career through. Okay. Now, he worked with McGeorge Bundy when John Kennedy became president. And the powers that be intended Richard Nixon to be president, but Kennedy won the election. So there's a little interim before Nixon could be their president, but they were all sitting and waiting on the sides. McGeorge Bundy came from Harvard, and a lot of the staff and the cabinet that John Kennedy selected were from Harvard. And McGeorge Bundy had been at Harvard. He was at Groton and Yale. He had a fellow at Harvard, and he was in charge of the defense for John Kennedy. And Kennedy gave him a very important role in our Defense Department. Now, in this book, it says Bundy was a central figure at Harvard at a time when Kissinger was scarcely known. But Kissinger was tapped long before Bundy even dreamt about it, probably. Both Bundy and Schlesinger were appointed by John Kennedy to be in the White House, along with many of his other friends. But Kissinger, this little sneaky rat, Kissinger enjoyed unofficial access to the kind of information that had not been so readily available during the Eisenhower years. When Eisenhower was president, Richard Nixon was vice president, Kissinger wasn't getting all that he wanted, but through the Harvard people, he begins to get it. And it says that Bundy invited Henry Kissinger, when John Kennedy was president, to become a part-time consultant to the National Security Council. He already was important in overthrowing Mossadegh and putting the Shah of Iran and being part of the CIA and the Harvard faculty. But when Kennedy was president, he was invited unofficially to be a consultant to the National Security Council to advise on German policy. And remember, his mentor, this Fritz Kramer from Germany, is sitting in the Pentagon, and his protege Kissinger has got his foot now as a German policy advisor in the behind doors. It says Kissinger would continue to teach at Harvard. You thought he was just a teacher there. But in fact, he gained access to papers that he would not otherwise have, and a massive safe was installed by our government in his Divinity Avenue address as the only external evidence of his new role. The Defense Department, the National Security Agency, stuck stuff in his safe up there in Boston. In the summer of 1961, before and after the building of the Berlin Wall, he went steadily to Washington. He commuted back and forth between Harvard and Washington. He wasn't in a position to impose his ideas on the White House yet, because in Washington, Bundy was the boss, and Kissinger made the grave mistake of thinking that he could advise them at the National Security Council. And this book says that he never fully appreciated the difficulty of working as a subordinate. He was ready to take over, and he had to be a subordinate for a while. And it said, and the people there that had come to Washington with Kennedy had pulled up their stakes and gone to Washington, in quotes, for the duration. The author put "for the duration." So Kissinger could only be a part-time consultant. Now, "for the duration" had to mean until John Kennedy's head was blown off. And 2 days later, Fritz Kramer in the Pentagon and Alexander Haig and the whole war machine escalated the war. Read the Pentagon papers and see the control that they had in getting the war in Vietnam going, but they had little slippery Kissinger there all of the time. Now, prior to that, in the same book, it tells about how the Rockefeller brothers set up a special studies project at Harvard. Rockefeller brothers fund a special studies project at Harvard prior to when Kennedy came in, 1956 to 58, and it was for Henry Kissinger and some of the members of his group are listed in the book, and I'm just going to give you a few of them. Adolph Burl Jr. Adolph Burl was the man who worked with Whitaker Chambers and Alger Hiss, prosecuting Alger Hiss, getting Richard Nixon's career going, and making the Cold War, the Red Scare. Adolph Burl Jr.'s name is through all the books on the Alger Hiss case. He was from Columbia University and at one time ambassador to Brazil. Another person in the special studies group was General Lucius Clay. He worked with Nazi Fritz Kramer, with Henry Kissinger, with a group at Omer Ammergau after the war, the World War II Nazis. He was sorry that Hitler lost the war. And Mr. Patton and General Patton and General Lucius Clay were two military monsters that were so pro-German. And he's put into the study group set up by the Rockefellers with Henry Kissinger. Another was Henry Luce. the man who in Life and Time, you know, had the speeches of Hitler, Mussolini, pro-Nazi, and, of course, Mr. Whitaker Chambers worked for Henry Luce before he began getting Alger Hiss discredited and removed from public office, and Alger Hiss went to jail. Luce had hired him and many other people that you know and has been a source of defending fascism and propaganda. Another in the class in this discussion was David Sarnoff of NBC. Now, that's very interesting because as soon as Kennedy is dead and as soon as Nixon is in, the man to sit by Henry Kissinger's side and travel with him for every speech, every trip, is either Bernard Kalb or particularly Marvin Kalb. And I've mentioned them in connection with Henry Kissinger and the scandal of Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger. So Mr. David Sarnoff, NBC, the man responsible for Marvin and Bernard Kalb, turning Kissinger over to them for the media coverage that he gets. Even today he was on TV bringing in a soccer team. He has to get his name in the news all the time because they're going to try and push him for president of the United States. Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, who was at Los Alamos and later at Lawrence Livermore Lab in Stanford. I don't have to tell you about Teller. He was part of that discussion group. And Ovetta Culb, C-U-L-B, Hobby, from the Houston CIA foundations where the black money, the death money coming out of Houston, Texas for the assassinations. And Leon Jaworski belonged to a CIA foundation in Houston, Texas. Houston was represented in that group. And interestingly enough, Justin Dart. Now, that is a link to the future of Ronald Reagan in the kitchen cabinet. He's one of the men that was pushing Ronald Reagan from very early time. He was part of the group at Harvard, the Rockefeller Brothers Fund. So Kennedy was followed. They knew everything he was doing. They escalated the war when he was over. And that is Snake Kissinger going back and forth with a trunk of goodies in his office in Boston. Goodness knows what the Pentagon was giving him when they were getting ready to blow off John Kennedy's head. Now, the rest of the program for the next 40 minutes, I'm going to talk about the Hitler Diary Part 2. I discussed it with you last week. Sometimes when I leave this station, I feel that I have really covered a lot of material and I'm taking you to another place that you can understand and follow. And sometimes, like last week, when I went home, I had given certain names on the air, like Gert Heidemann, H-E-I-D-E-M-A-N-N, and S.S. Karl Wolff, and S.S. Brigadefuhrer Wilhelm Mohnke, M-O-H-N-K-E. And I said, it doesn't matter who wrote the diaries. Let's zoom in on the people that are involved because the people is the story, not the ink, the paper, and so forth. And as it turned out, this is what is happening. The people are the story. And when I left last week and I talked about the pilots, the Lufthansa airline, I wondered, are people really understanding what I'm saying about the diary? Do they understand the importance of whatever it is that surfaced now? It is the people that surfaced now. More that we'll find out about the paper and the ink and the bindings later. But who are these dogs that worked with Mr. Gert Heidemann that were the excuse for the diary? It was the people. So I want to discuss some of those people in detail with you tonight. So I gave you their names last week and continue from what I did. And if you didn't have that broadcast, you can get the tape cassettes. It's taped off the air, and you can get that broadcast, part one or part two of the Hitler Diary. Now, there was an article in the London Observer, The Tragic History of Double Dack. The R-E is silent. D-A-C-R-E. I call him Count Dracula. You can call him anything you want, or you can call him U. Trevor Roper, because that was his name before he was knighted by the Queen. The London Observer has a story, and it really did my heart good, because I have a lot of patience, and 5 years ago, on broadcast number 339, that was in July 1978, I was talking about U. Trevor Roper and Mark Lane, two of those whores of history who have not told the truth, have not told the whole truth, who have been so deceptive and have been in the attention of the media, and their lies have not been exposed for what they were. And finally, an article in the London Observer, it says, I'll quote the author, his name is Connor Cruz O'Brien, The Tragic History of Double Dack. Okay, I'll give you just a few sentences of what he says. I'm not all that worried about whether the Hitler diaries are genuine, and that's what I tried to tell you. He said, I'm getting a bit worried about whether Lord Dak is genuine. Who was this individual who did so much to say the diaries were authentic? I suggest that the real Lord Dak, you, Trevor Roper, a suave and sinister man, a master of deceit, betrayed the confidence of the free world. His reputation as a historian stands particularly high among the non-historians who make up the bulk of the population. Now, this is the man that was sent in by Winston Churchill to tell the world how Hitler died without ever getting any of the facts that were not clear at all. And he was legion. He's always been quoted about that story. Now, I am sure if he tried to pull that in 1983 after Watergate and the Church Committee and the Rockefeller Committee and all the exposés, it wouldn't wash in Peoria or anywhere else. And the London Observer says, this is a serious matter when an individual answering to the name of a pillar of society steps forward to authenticate what is possibly an artifact. What evidence do I have for my hypothesis that Lord Dak, for whom we've been hearing so much lately, must really be another fellow altogether? I'll call him Double Dak, the London Observer said. I have a lot more evidence for that than Dak or Double Dak has for any authenticity of those diaries. And this man goes on to say, I'm satisfied that they're not authentic, but he asked the question, how did he put himself in that position? And then he said, it is too late to turn back what he said. And you, Trevor Roper, said, I put my career, my reputation on the line. He said, it is too late to turn back what he said. The statement remains on the record. He vouched for these 60 volumes without even seeing more than two. He had unlimited time. In a few hours, he called London. London Times hires him, and he tells them, yes, you can go ahead with him. He said the deficiencies are in his reasoning and his evidence, and they cannot be removed. That is not the way historians are supposed to act. In defending himself, Lord Dak said he was working under certain constraints. Getting back to the Warren Report, to John J. McCloy on the commission, Gerald Ford, who's living and traveling around very prosperous, and John McCone was CIA director of this whole charade when Kennedy was murdered. He lives right here on Monterey Peninsula. These people did not tell the story about what happened. And Lord Dak is excusing himself. I worked under certain constraints. And this London Observer is saying, what constraints was he under? This is exactly what John McCloy and Alan Dulles and Gerald Ford and the entire staff of the Warren Commission, hundreds of lawyers and witnesses, were manipulated. And he says the diaries appear to be garbage, but Lord Dak thinks the sheer quality of the garbage is evidence of its authenticity. And getting back to the John Kennedy assassination, they thought if they put 26 volumes out and sold them around, made them very expensive, and sold them, that the sheer volumes, that nobody would go through them. In fact, Alan Dulles said it at one of the meetings, print it because no one will read it. Well, it took a long time for somebody publicly to call attention to this man because, as I say, on broadcast number 339, this was in July 1978, I mentioned that you, Trevor Roper, wrote the introduction to Mark Lane's Rush to Judgment. It wasn't a bad book, but Mark Lane, in all these years and 20 years, has left out the Nazi connections of Nazi criminal Walter Dornberger, the Permandex operation coming out of Rome with John Connolly and Albert Osborne, the Argentine connections to the Nazis, to Alexander Zeiger, the Division 5 of the FBI, the use of the NASA space scientists, the intelligence system. Mark Lane, for 20 years, has diverted away from the people who killed John Kennedy and has stayed on the grassy knoll. He should have by now been able to count every blade of grass. Now, I mentioned Sylvia Marr a couple weeks ago, leaving out the names of the Munich people that came to kill John Kennedy. Why, on the anniversary of Kennedy's death 20 years later, am I turning you on to some of the lies of history? Well, I really owe it to you because you have to be able to know the difference between what is told and what is left out and why it's taken 20 years to get the story. Now, another story from the same London Observer, while they're writing about Lord Dak, was an outrageous statement, and I want to share that with you. Maybe we should take a break before we get into the London Observer story to show you how the news is manipulated, the major stories of writers, depending on who is selected to do the story. They divert you away from the facts and try to make your mind be so far off that you remember the details of the mistakes and not read further to check out the facts for yourself. We'll take a 1-minute break. This is KAZU-FM.